In this week's episode, Kate Perry is joined by Oliver Nguyen. Oliver's a financial planner from GPC Wealth Management. They discuss the McLeod remedy, specifically with regards to the contingent decisions and including the latest updates. They also talk about other changes relating to pensions. These were introduced in last year's budget.
Accountancy on Prescription by RBP, one of the leading firms of medical specialist accountants. We know what you find tough, but don't you worry, as we know our stuff.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Accountancy on Prescription. I'm Kate Perry, one of the partners here at RBP, and today I'm joined once again by our friend and colleague Oliver Nguyen. And Oliver is a financial planner. So today we're going to be talking about pensions, of course, including the McLeod remedy, which I know a lot of you are still wondering what on earth is going on. Also, some new things that have come up. And in particular, we're going to talk about contingent decisions. So while you may be wondering what on earth I'm talking about, I'm going to pass on to Ollie and get him to explain what contingent decisions are. So hello, Ollie, and welcome to the show again.
Hi, Kate. Thanks very much for having me on again.
So what are contingent decisions?
So contingent decisions relates to the McLeod remedy, which I think everyone is fairly well versed in, but very briefly to recap, McLeod relates to the introduction of the 2015 scheme in 2015. The fact that that was deemed to be age discriminatory, there had to be a remedy for that, and members didn't end up joining the 2015 scheme until 2022. So they moved back into their legacy scheme, 2008 or 1995 scheme, for an additional seven-year period from 2015 through to 2022. Ultimately, the scheme membership retrospectively changed. And what that meant was, because they had kind of changed the playing field and moved the goalposts, what that means is that members may retrospectively, therefore, wish to change their historic pension decisions. In short, some members may have opted out of the pension scheme at the point that they thought they were going into the 2015 scheme. But had they known that actually they weren't going to join the 2015 scheme until 7 years later in 2022, they might well have acted differently. And contingent decisions gives them the opportunity to retrospectively remake those decisions and decide actually what they wanted the structure of their membership to look like in terms of whether they were active or deferred during the seven-year remedy period, 2015 through to 2022.
And of course, we've got a lot of clients who did what we term as the sort of okey-cokey, where when they went over their annual allowance and they had a tax charge because of that, they were choosing to opt in and opt out. And we've got some clients who opted in and out over the period as well. So they also can choose to go back in for the whole period as well. But I think you're specifically looking at those who may well have been out for longer or for the whole period, if you like.
I think contingent decisions will impact anyone that had any period of deferral during that period. And it would be worthwhile for them to revisit it, because there could be some benefits in structuring their membership in a different way. The most obvious example of where this potentially could be beneficial for a GP is where a GP, being unaware of the implication, decided to defer from the scheme for a period that exceeded 5 years. The GP pension scheme is a career average revalued earnings scheme. And what that effectively means is every single year you're a member, you're buying some pension based upon your pensionable pay in that year, but the historic pension you've earned is dynamized. It means it grows with inflation. And for active members, the revaluation of that historic pension grows at CPI inflation plus 1.5% per year. If you're deferred from the scheme, you don't get that additional 1.5% per year. And that's permanently removed from the point of exit or deferral once a member exceeds the pension for longer than 5 years. So if a member decided to defer from the scheme, my advice to them, and I think your advice to your clients as well, is that, yes, you must always go back in
within that 5 year period.
Yeah, before the 60th month, effectively, because that additional 1.5% revaluation is incredibly valuable. So there are some clients or members who unknowingly had a period of deferral for longer than 5 years. Now they have the opportunity to go back and purchase maybe 1 month, which would break any period of 5 years plus as deferral. And when we've modelled this previously for members that we know are in that situation, that 1 month of additional membership being purchased retrospectively as a result of contingent decisions has the potential to increase their pension by maybe £10,000 a year for every year in retirement when they come to draw on their pension. So it's an incredibly big opportunity.
Yes, that's really more than I think anyone might have imagined would be the case. So that extra £10,000 is only when they're given back the uplift for those 5 years.
Yeah, that's the value of the uplift. So that's an example of a potentially very sizable benefit that contingent decisions creates for a fairly distinct group of people who have opted out or deferred from the scheme for a period longer than 5 years. But actually, anyone that opted out during the remedy period at all, there still could be benefit, because the rationale for them opting out during that remedy period may well have been because they felt that they were in an inferior scheme, the 2015 scheme, whereas now with rollback, they're not. They're in what they perhaps felt was a more superior scheme, the 1995 scheme. So my view personally would be, if you had any period of deferral, you've got an opportunity to go back and review whether that was a wise decision or not. And there's a reasonable chance that it wasn't the wisest decision now on reflection, given what's changed. So having the opportunity to go back and review that and just confirm that you did make the right decisions, with the ability to retrospectively alter them if they weren't proven to be the right decisions, I think that's a sensible thing to do. So if I was a member and had been deferred during that period, I would certainly be looking to see what opportunities contingent decisions creates for me.
Right. And in order to do that, they would need assistance from somebody like you in order to do that.
Probably not. No one ever has a requirement to receive advice. But I think when we're talking about NHS pensions, which is a complicated beast at the best of times, and certainly liaising and understanding the processes that have been put in place to deal with these types of things, taking advice often is favourable in terms of making sure that you process things correctly, and you do so by protecting your time as much as anything else. So contingent decisions is kind of the final thing in relation to McLeod. So the process isn't completely defined at this stage, but what you can do at this point is you can contact NHS Pensions and request a quote to buy back any previously deferred or opted out membership. So you would use the application to buy back opted out service form, which is available on the NHS Pension website. It's quite a complicated form. I think most members would struggle to complete that as a minimum without the support of an accountant. An accountant for a GP, certainly a GP partner, is going to be helpful in that scenario, because the information that's required on that form should be fairly readily available through the member's accountant. The process, as we understand it, is once that's been completed, that would then be submitted to NHS Pensions, and NHS Pensions will provide an illustration or a quote as to the cost of buying back any previously deferred membership. Now, our advice at the moment is that that should be completed on the assumption that you're going to buy back every single day that you were deferred during the remedy period. As I touched upon earlier on, the likelihood is the optimal outcome isn't going to be buying back every single day of previous deferral. It's going to be a case of maybe purchasing back just a selection of that period, a part of that period, maybe even just 1 month for certain members. But if we can understand what the cost is of buying back the entirety of the deferred membership, we can then work from that to model what the optimal outcome is. And the optimal outcome, when we're modelling from a financial planning perspective, is looking to acquire the most amount of additional pension at the best price. Exactly. Yes. So looking to maximise value. And, and there are some circumstances where that will be, you know, the cost of the additional period of membership will immediately be offset by the benefits that are accumulated, including additional pension commencement lump sum, tax-free cash that the member might be entitled to on the first day of retirement. So in some instances, it will be an absolute no-brainer.
Okay, so that's really, really helpful, Ollie, because I think even I didn't really fully understand.
If I just interject briefly, Kate, sorry to interrupt, but once that quote has been acquired from NHS Pensions and the modelling, which likely will be done with the support of some kind of advice from financial planners to identify what the correct optimal purchase is. We don't yet know, because it's not yet defined, what the process of actually interacting with NHS pensions to finalise that repurchase will be. So there needs to be some further clarification from NHS pensions as to how the actual end part of that process is completed.
So basically, who you pay and when you pay them, and then making sure that that payment and the whole process does get into your pension scheme at the end of the day.
Exactly that. Yeah. The practicality of finalising it is as yet undefined. Yes. But my view would be becoming informed and understanding what it is that you want to finalise puts you in the perfect position to finalise it once we know what that final process looks like.
Yes. So having said all that, some of the people listening, in fact, I think it's probably more the majority than minority. A lot of people still haven't received their RPSS statement. So I think that's one of the issues. So I think as we were discussing before we came on air, we were talking about how the original date, everyone was supposed to have received their RPSS by September 24.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then that was kicked back and everyone was supposed to have got them, I think, February, or they gave another date. And I think now they've come up with some more dates. I think July 31st, in theory, for most people. I think people who've taken their pension, some people are going to be more delayed. So I think current members are sort of being put in front of retired members. Is that as you understand it?
Yeah, it's important to clarify because there's easily some confusion around this. So in relation to McLeod, there are two parts to McLeod. So the first part is the rollback. It's the remedy for the age discrimination that existed with the initial introduction of McLeod. So the rollback, the initial part of the remedy, is to move everyone back into their legacy scheme so that they don't re-enter or enter the 2015 scheme until 2022. Initially, the vast majority joined in 2015, but the remedy ruled that members, or the remedy off the back of the ruling, is that they're not going to join until 2022. So they're rolled back into their legacy scheme. And what that means is the annual growth of their pension membership during the remedy period will change because they're in a different scheme. So previously, initially during the period 2015 through to 2022, members received their annual allowance pension saving statements based upon being in their 2015 scheme. And more often than not, by their accountants, they reported the pension growth against their available allowance and possibly annual allowance tax charges to HMRC were settled. And that all changes because the structure of the membership changes. They're now back into their legacy scheme. So the growth figure of their membership changes for each year during that period. They first need to be provided with what's known as a RPSS, Remedial Pension Savings Statement, which will show the new growth in each year versus the previous growth. And upon receipt of that document, where annual allowance tax charges were previously incurred, it needs to be re-reported to HMRC and potentially scheme pays elections need to be resubmitted. This is a process you'll be very familiar with, Kate. I'm sure you're doing for lots and lots of clients. So the RPSSs were intended to be received by every member by September 2024, but that deadline was missed and continues to be missed for 18,000 GPs, which is a pretty significant number.
So is that a recent number that they've published? So 18,000 GPs.
18,000 GPs have not
18,000 GPs. So we're not even talking including consultants, because we obviously act for a lot of consultants as well. And a lot of them haven't received them either because they're all in the same bracket. Gosh, I'm sure we're going to get kicked back again on the deadlines. So I think one thing just to point out to the listeners is don't worry too much if you still haven't got it, but you do need to be taking action to try and make sure that there isn't a particular holdup, but we'll come to that shortly.
Yeah, if you haven't received it, you're not on your own. There's lots and lots of people in a similar boat. So there's nothing unique necessarily to your situation that means that it's a particularly special case. Actually, it's just a poorly delivered process. And generally speaking, those people that haven't received their RPSS yet is because there isn't sufficient information at NHS pensions to be able to produce the RPSS, or a manual calculation of the RPSS needs to be calculated. So if we look at those two situations in isolation, where there's not enough information, a good example of why that might be the case is PCSE may not have processed the superannual pay information in an effective way and forwarded that information onto NHS pensions. So because PCSE haven't forwarded the required information to NHS pensions, NHS pensions are therefore unable to produce the annual allowance growth figures and therefore the RPSS. Where there's a manual calculation required, a good example would be a portfolio GP, perhaps someone who has some officer employment alongside practice profit share or salary yes. GP work. A manual calculation would be required in that scenario, and there's just clearly a lack of resource at NHS pensions to be able to work through that more complicated set of calculations.
Yeah, as far as I understand, it is quite complicated. I've dealt with some clients who've been in that situation when we were just trying to get their annual allowance statements, and even that was a struggle because I think it is really very complex when they're trying to marry up what is essentially a hospital post with a GP. Because, of course, historically, GPs were on the average earnings scheme, whereas consultants were on the final
exactly.
salary scheme, and trying to merge the two together, I think that's where the complication lies. And they've obviously got very few specialist people who can actually physically do that calculation.
Exactly that. So if you haven't received your RPSS, you're not on your own. It will be provided at some point further down the line. I can't give you a timescale as to when that will be. I doubt NHS pensions can with any real confidence. But the important thing to understand is when you do receive that RPSS, that is the prompt that you need to do something. You need to engage with your accountant and or your advisor, because the likelihood is you will have some additional reporting to do off the back of that to HMRC. And you have 3 months ultimately, or potentially just 3 months, to be able to process that. So when you receive the RPSS, I always say to my clients, I don't know whether you do the same, Kate, if you receive any correspondence from NHS pensions, just send it to me so that I can quickly cast my eye over it and I can let you know what you need to do in terms of the next step.
So we've been telling our clients that if they get their statements, that they need to send it directly to us, so that we can deal with that, because adjustments are required for HMRC. Most of the work is required by them directly, but we just have to tell them what it is they need to do, really. And NHS pensions and HMRC liaise with each other as to whether there are changes to the scheme pay elections. If you did pay yourself, however, sometimes it can result in refunds, actual refunds to you, because you might have overpaid. Alternatively, you then have the option, if you've underpaid, whether you pay yourself or whether you actually want a scheme pay election to cover that additional charge. So it is quite a process. I think we had a client the other day who told us that they'd filed the document and hadn't sent it to us. So it is important that as soon as you get it, you do send it on to us. And just to add to that about those people who haven't received them, I know a lot of our clients are aware that we're trying to ensure that PCSE get the right documentation to be able to do their updates. There are some, and they did start sending out letters to people to say we're missing this year because you've got an open employment. But I don't think everyone who was in that situation got the letter. So it's probably worth contacting NHS pensions in the first instance to see what years they have missing on their records, to then go back to PCSE and try and fill in those gaps. So I've got a lot of GPs who are missing periods from their salary GP days, or even hospital periods where, I don't know, an employment was left open and they haven't got closure on it, or they haven't got type 2 certificates that were prepared, because in the early days, no salary GP were even aware they had to do a type 2 certificate. So it's filling in all those gaps. And one thing that we do recommend, if you're really not sure what's going on with your historical employment, is to ask NHS pensions for a service extract, because that then summarises everything from when you joined the superannuation scheme. So you can just check you've got something, you know you were working in the NHS, you should have had superannual salary, and you can check that you've got something in for every year. So it's well worth doing that check, particularly if you haven't got your RPSS and you think there are holes somewhere in your system. So I think there's still a lot of work that people have got to do to get themselves into the position to even produce the RPSS. But there is a backlog, I think, within NHS pensions to actually produce these documents, because I think they just completely miscalculated how long this work would take because it's more
absolutely
complicated.
And government ministers are now going in to kind of establish why this is taking so long and put some pressure on making sure that actually this is turned around much quicker. The reality is, when my clients certainly receive information from NHS pensions, it's very difficult really without a trained eye to understand what's being communicated in that correspondence. So put simply, when you receive bits from NHS pensions, my advice is engage with your advisors and accountants. Certainly in relation to the RPSS, that's likely to prompt further reporting. So it's a really, really important document not to ignore and to action upon receipt. The second document which members will receive potentially in fullness of time, potentially quite soon, is something known as an RSS, so a remedial savings statement, which is a ridiculous name in my opinion, given how easy it is to confuse that with the RPSS. Yes. It would have made much more sense to call that something like McLeod Part 2 Choice. But this document relates to the second part rather than the first part of McLeod. And the second part of McLeod is, when you come to retire, you will have the opportunity to unwind or reverse the first part of McLeod. So the first part of McLeod is moving everyone back into their legacy scheme up until 2022.
So that's an automatic process. So that everybody automatically, without choice, gets rolled back.
Exactly.
So this is now the choice. You can then make the decision as to whether you did actually want that situation to occur.
For some members, and they're expected to be in the minority, when they come to retire, it might be that actually if they calculated their pension accrual based upon joining the 2015 scheme in 2015, it's possible that that might be favourable. And so there is the option to unwind the rollback and to say, actually, I wanted to join the 2015 scheme in 2015. So that's a decision, that's the second part of McLeod that's made at the point that you retire and take your pension benefits. And there are lots and lots of people that have already retired in recent years that haven't yet had that choice. For active members who are going to retire kind of 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line, they will also be given that choice at the point that they retire. So members who have recently retired will also receive that McLeod Part 2 choice through what's known as a remedial services statement. And it's possible that they will receive that remedial savings statement before they receive their remedial pension savings statement. So they will be given the choice because they've retired and they've taken the default position as it is, but they will be given the choice of a different set of pension benefits. They will have to make that choice. And then subsequently, they will receive a remedial pension savings statement, which potentially changes some of their historic scheme pays elections. So it's possible that in receipt of a pension, it may be amended once the RPSS has been processed. So to keep it simple, when you receive your remedial savings statement, if you are fairly recently retired, and this could be at any point between now and December 2026, my advice is to take some advice. There's some compensation, the cost claim back service will cover professional fees up to £500 inclusive of VAT if you wanted some advice at the point of receipt of that document. So I guess at a very, very high level, the message here is when you receive documentation from NHS pensions in the coming years, my advice would be to seek some professional advice from people that understand the scheme and can make sure that you're making the correct decisions, but also taking the correct actions in terms of reporting as well.
Although the logic of that doesn't seem to follow. If they haven't done the RPSS calculation, how can they give you the two choices?
Because they've rolled back everyone into their legacy scheme. That's already been done. So they can calculate the two.
So they've got sort of some of the information, but not enough to actually completely.
I agree with you. It doesn't seem to follow logic the way that it's calculated.
Yes. But we are getting a lot of clients who are getting RPSSs where we know actually their data isn't correct. We're completing that as received, even though we're thinking we're probably going to get a new one, because we know that if we have to do the whole exercise again, the compensation will still cover that.
However many times you need to submit it, you don't want to miss the deadlines, which is why you would process it upon receipt.
Yes.
But if you then challenge and say the data you provided was incorrect and they resend you new data, then you can reprocess and claim back the professional charges used to complete that process. Because ultimately, if they've given you that information, then you shouldn't be disadvantaged in terms of reporting on the back of that.
Okay, so I think for that area that we were going to talk about, we've probably covered that. So just to go back in time a little bit, There were other changes to pensions that were introduced in last year's budget. Could you just clarify exactly what those were? I think that's to do with other pensions rather than just the NHS.
Yeah, so in the budget last year, which was the most anticipated budget that I can recall, and was clearly a pretty feared and unfavourable budget in terms of the tax take that Rachel Reeves announced across a number of different areas. One of the alterations, which wasn't headline news because perhaps it doesn't impact as many people as some of the other changes like the national insurance changes, was around defined contribution pensions, and specifically defined contribution pensions forming part of someone's estate from 2027 and therefore potentially becoming liable to inheritance tax. So if I explain this from the top fairly briefly, NHS pension members have what are known as defined benefit pensions. So there's no capital value that they hold at any given point in time. There's a lack of flexibility, but they're brilliant schemes because they offer guaranteed retirement incomes for as long as someone lives into retirement. And generally speaking, defined benefit schemes have been phased out of the private sector because they're too expensive, unsustainable, and they continue to represent an amazing part of the total remuneration that a public sector worker receives.
But of course, with that sort of pension, the pension dies with...
Exactly. Exactly. So it's never going to form part of the state or become subject to inheritance tax. Within the private sector, and certainly if members want to save into pensions on a personal basis, they use what are called money purchase or defined contribution schemes. And what this means is the contributions by you and your employer go into a fund, which typically will purchase underlying investments, and you look to accumulate this fund over time, to increase the fund over time. And when you come to retire, you then have this investment that you can utilize to produce retirement income. And if someone was to pass away having not fully utilised their fund, i.e. there was a residual fund left, then they can bequeath that to their beneficiaries. They can leave any remaining value to their beneficiaries. Now, in the recent past, those pensions have started to become used as an estate planning tool. So if I think about a fairly typical example that I might come up with in my working life, so I have a GP client or a hospital doctor who has a fabulous NHS pension. And that, alongside two state pensions in a household, is going to do much of the heavy lifting, providing retirement income for
probably
that.
Most of it, too.
Absolutely.
To be honest. Yeah.
Maybe more than it's required to do. So
Yes. That's
going to produce the retirement lifestyle living costs for the spouses in that household. But the second spouse has a successful career working in the private sector and has accumulated a significant pension in their own right on a defined contribution basis. Well, that pension is the most tax-efficient asset as it stands for that couple. They don't necessarily need it, so the advice would be to leave it where it is, have it as a contingency. If you do need it, you can draw upon it at your discretion. But if you don't need it, you can bequeath it to your beneficiaries. And whilst all of the other assets in your estate are likely to be subject to inheritance tax, the pension would be completely exempt. So
Yes. You know,
it could be £1 million maybe sitting in that defined contribution arrangement that is exempt from inheritance tax and therefore saving their beneficiaries £400,000 worth in tax. Rachel Reeves' announcement was defined contribution pensions were never meant to be an estate planning tool. They were meant to be a tool to produce retirement income. And as a result of that, from 2027, she is going to remove the exemption from inheritance tax. She's going to bring the value of that pension into someone's estate. So if someone's estate is already subject to inheritance tax, anything in their pension that comes into the estate in 2027 is also going to be subject. So in that example where maybe there's £1 million in the pension, that immediately creates an inheritance tax liability of an additional £400,000. So that is an enormous change for people that would be affected or might be affected, but often has gone under the radar. And on that basis, my advice would be that it's something that's important to review because the planning changes from 2027.
And this would be the same for anyone doing SIPs, because I know we've got sort of hospital consultants with limited companies, and some of the money they're putting from the company into SIPs or other personal pension schemes, and they would all suffer under this change in the regulations. And is there another rule that if it remains within the pension, when the beneficiaries draw down that income, they then pay additional tax to get the money out? So it's sort of like a double hit.
Exactly that. So I call this with my clients the importance of age 75. So the rule currently as it stands, if someone with a personal pension or SIP passes away and they bequeath those assets to their beneficiaries, if they're under the age of 75, as it stands today, those pension funds would be inherited without liability to inheritance tax. And whoever the beneficiary is, and it's really, really important to put good thought behind who you're nominating as your beneficiaries. There's some very, very valuable flexibility that you can build in by correctly wording the nomination of beneficiaries on your personal pension. Whoever the beneficiary is, if they inherit it and the member has passed away younger than age 75, they can then draw the value out of that SIP without any liability to income tax as well as inheritance tax. If the member, as it stands today, passes away and they're over the age of 75, as it stands, there would be no inheritance tax, but the beneficiary who inherits the fund, as they draw value from the SIP or personal pension, would be subject to income tax at their highest marginal rate.
In the same way that the individual who had the pension, if they'd been drawing the pension, they would be paying tax on that drawdown.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, if you have a personal pension, let's say you retire at 60 and you start to draw income from your personal pension at 60, typically you can take 25% of the fund tax-free, but the remaining 75, when you start to draw upon that, will be taxed at your highest marginal rate. Yes. Actually, in the name of a beneficiary, if the pension member who is bequeathing the asset passes away before the age of 75, the beneficiary then has 100% access to that fund without any liability to income tax. And that's a really, really important point, because what that means is, as it stands today, that pension for that hypothetical member is their most tax-efficient asset. My advice to my clients is draw on every other asset in your estate to reduce the size of your estate before you start to think about drawing on the pension.
Yes. Yeah, but my own financial advisor was saying exactly that. Don't touch your pension. Don't touch your pension.
Exactly right. But in the future, when someone gets beyond age 75 and it's post-2027, they bequeath their pension to their beneficiary, potentially incurring up to 40% inheritance tax on that fund. And once it's incurred 40% inheritance tax, so the beneficiary inherits, let's say, 60% of the fund, and then they start to draw income, they also then incur their own income tax on any drawings they take from it. Now, if that beneficiary is a 40% or 45% taxpayer,
another 40%.
Then that asset is being enormously...
You're down to 20% of it, basically.
Very, very punitively taxed.
Right.
So effectively, the personal pension asset goes from currently being the most tax-efficient asset to post-2027, potentially the least tax-efficient asset. And what that means is there has to be a change in planning strategy for that asset thereafter. Now, for lots and lots of people, they are blissfully unaware of that law change. The other two points I would make on that is, first and foremost, there's no urgency. We've got until 2027 before anything potentially needs to be done. It still makes sense to keep it where it is for the time being. And secondly, I think the reason that they've selected 2027 as the time that the legislation changes is because they need to work through what that legislation actually looks like. Suddenly, you're going to have pension scheme administrators who are potentially responsible for paying inheritance tax from pensions to HMRC. That's quite a seismic change. And on that basis, we don't yet know specifically what the terms of that will be. Is there a pension nil rate band, for example? Is the rate of tax 40% on inheritance on pensions, or is it a different rate? So there's a little bit to be clarified, but at this stage, it's important to kind of notify your clients. If you're holding personal pension funds, there is a big change coming, and moving forward, the planning around that asset is likely to change as a result of that.
Yes. So we as accountants, we did put it in our budget notification to our clients.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that it, as you say, people haven't really spoken about it. If you've got an IFA, they will always be talking to you about it. But I think a lot of people don't, or they're younger. But it's certainly something to think about. And when you mentioned this age 75, I remember now that that was a specific line to watch. And of course, everyone's living longer. So the likelihood of somebody going over the age of 75 is really quite high these days. So,
and I touched upon it earlier on, a trick that is often missed is the expression of wish or nomination of beneficiaries form. So to put it simply as I can, most people would bequeath their assets to their spouse. Typically, that's the most common thing that we see. Not always the case, but that's the most common thing. So with my own pension, what I do is I bequeath my pension to my wife, but I've nominated as secondary beneficiaries all of my children. And in the fullness of time, I may add grandchildren. The importance of these different family members being named enables the pension trustee to alter the nomination of beneficiary if it's appropriate to do so and as dictated by the beneficiaries at the point that they bequeathed the pension. So, for example, if my wife is going to be subject to income tax on an inherited pension, she may say, actually, I'd rather pay it to the grandchildren because they don't have any income tax. They're at university maybe, and it will help them pay for their university fees.
Right.
So you can kind of consider the pension as a bit of a trust and try and manage it as a trust. And that enables more tax efficient and flexible options in the long run.
That's a really useful piece of information. Yes. So I think that was the main thing from the budget, certainly with regard to pensions, that we wanted to highlight today. And I think, to be honest, that's probably everything for today. I think we've gone on rather longer than we anticipated, but hopefully everyone will find something of use within that. So thank you very much, Ollie.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And good to see you again. So until next time, a note to everyone that this will be our last episode for the time being, as we're just taking a break for the summer holidays. But we will be back in September with series 3. So keep your eyes open for that, please. I think it's about a month off for the summer. So if you enjoyed listening to this, please share and subscribe. And when we come back in September, we will continue with our fortnightly podcast. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Ollie, and goodbye for now.
You have been listening to RBP's Accountancy on Prescription podcast. For any updates, please visit www.rbp.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at RBPCA. The contents of this podcast is for general guidance and informational purposes only and does not constitute any form of advice. The information provided by RBP is of a general nature. Appropriate and tailored advice or independent research should be obtained before making any decisions. RBP does not accept any liability for any loss or damage which is incurred from you acting or not acting as a result of listening to Accountancy on Prescription.